The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I delve into the magic of cinema and the alchemy of acting with Sir Ben Kingsley as he plays the original innovator, George Méliès, in Martin Scorsese's new film, Hugo. And Zan Brooks and I will be reviewing some of the week's other big releases, including the Argentinian road trip adventure Las Acacias, Anna Paquin starring in Margaret, and Nanni Moretti exploring a doubting pontiff in We Have a Pope. Yes, it's the podcast that keeps the faith. It's Film Weekly. One of this festive season's biggest releases is Martin Scorsese's Hugo, a magical movie about an orphan who lives in a Paris train station and who befriends a surly toy salesman who may just turn out to be one of the great magicians of early cinema, George Méliès, the man who shot a rocket into the moon's eye. The rundown toy maker is another high watermark performance from Sir Ben Kingsley, the sort of actor who, when he's good, he's up there with the very, very best. From his Oscar-winning breakthrough screen performance as Gandhi in 1982, to the unforgettable dignity of Itzhak Stern in Schindler's List, to the demonic London gangster Don Logan in Sexy Beast, Sir Ben allies intelligence to technique to create an incandescent screen presence. Méliès in Hugo may be one of his gentler characters, but, as he revealed when I met him earlier this week, the part required all of the actor's trademark intensity, ushering in thoughts of mortality and decay, as well as playing with cinematic wonder.
Fix it. I know you've been stealing parts from the shop. Might as well use those you haven't stolen yet. You've got a bit of talent.
Sir Ben Kingsley, welcome to Film Weekly again, and congratulations on playing one of cinema's great magicians, George Méliès.
Yeah, great opportunity to explore cinema magic with another cinema magician, Martin Scorsese. Yeah.
Not the first time you've done it for him. You were in Shutter Island,
Island as well. Yeah, it's also a mystery, Shutter Island, and it's also a plot that has to unravel in its own time and keep the audience on the edge of their seats in a different way. But yeah, absolutely.
Did you know much about Méliès before you began this? I mean, presumably you knew the image of the rocket in the eye of the moon.
Yeah, I knew that image, but I didn't. I knew little about the fact that he destroyed most of his work, that he burnt a lot of his props and costumes, that, you know, his beautiful studio collapsed. He collapsed as well. I mean, the disintegration of that studio is the disintegration of him too. And he calls himself a broken, wind-up toy, and that's what Hugo has to fix. He loves fixing things, and
It's like that lovely mouse that there's a lovely scene where you get Hugo to fix a mouse for him, and in some respects that's Méliès himself.
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely. Yeah, and we get an opportunity to see Georges Méliès at his heyday when he's in the studio directing, writing, choreographing, doing the visual effects, the special effects, designing the costumes, painting the scenery, doing everything for that studio.
Is it something? It was interesting to see you doing that, and you attacked it with great relish as well. It was a lovely part for you as well. It almost in a way a theatrical part, reminded me of something like The Alchemist as well, that you could actually sort of just put on costumes and do everything. Is that something you've always wanted to do? I mean, you're such a fantastic actor, but I've never seen you kind of hurl yourself into every aspect of filmmaking as much as you did as George Méliès.
Well, in life, I would like to see my films on my slate produced. So as well as being an actor, I am a film producer, and I'm hoping to be working quite closely with the team of people I'm working with now. I don't think I'll ever direct. I love working with writers. That's what I really enjoy that. Mm-hmm. Especially, which surprised me, when they're developing roles for me. I didn't think that I would enjoy that so much. I rather thought that, you know, I take a backward step away from that and allow the script to surprise me.
Yeah.
But now, in my collaboration with one or two really amazing writers, I'm beginning to put in not my colours, but the characters' colours. Mm-hmm. And I have to keep that separation.
And we're going to see those films, are we?
I really hope so, yes, yes. It's always, for me, I think, and for you too, knowing the industry as well as you do, a collection of amazing miracles that the film ever hits the screen.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. But that's what Hugo is about, really, in a sense, a collection of amazing miracles. I mean, that's what George Méliès' toy shop is, you know, everything in there, but also all his films as well. Were you aware of the magic that was needed? Because to create magic is obviously very much hard work. When you were on set with Scorsese, did you know that the ineffable feeling he was going for at the end?
No, mainly because I think that Marty was, he does in a sense have the whole movie in his head, but at the same time, working with 3D, he was also making it up as he went along, which was thrilling to be with and thrilling to behold. But the set gave us a lot of information. When you realise that Dante Ferretti had put books on the library shelves, not real French books, mm-hmm. on the library shelves, real fruit in the fruit store, pâtisseries, bread, wine in the wine shops, coffee. It smelt and looked wonderful, that station. Mm-hmm. And it was massive, as you can imagine. Not a lot of CGI. That is a huge soundstage at Shepperton Studios. So you were able to completely inhabit that world. So it did give the actors a really strong sense of that environment and how magic it was to be in. And it's even more magic on the screen.
It's interesting to me to see you playing recently, not that long ago, you played Fagin from Polanski when,
right.
when you were in charge of sort of urchin boys. And I was reminded of that here when George is confronted by Ace the Butterfield as Hugo, another boy. It's something that you, for a long time, one didn't act with children, and now you do.
Some of my favourite experiences on screen have been with children. For the BBC, quite a while ago now, I did a beautiful version, I acted in a lovely version of Silas Marner, who adopts a little girl. I also am very fond of a film called Searching for Bobby Fischer, in which I teach a little boy how to play chess. Yeah. There is a thread, I think, in my work where I either play a parent or an adoptive parent. And I just love that role. I really enjoy working with very, very young actors. There's something uncluttered and unfiltered about their work. It's so brilliantly spontaneous.
The joy of playing Méliès, because he's a legend in a way, kind of a mystery,
yes.
figure. You have to flesh him out and make him human.
Yes.
What did you have to work with other than the script? Did you use the work? Did you use the legend? Did you use some historical references?
What I used was watching him at his peak, totally empowered by his job, and also, of course, reenacted all that for Marty, you know, at his height in the studio. A great film director and choreographer and dancer, acrobat, magician. And from that, I worked, extrapolated what it might feel like if all that was taken away.
Mm.
Not only that, but I did realize, watching his films, that doing all his own stunts, he probably sustained a collection of minor injuries all over his body. And when you stop, I would imagine that when you stop that particular activity, be it a sport or a profession, that involves the fitness of the body, all the little injuries would probably have kicked in with him. So his walk degenerated, his posture degenerated. He, you know, at the beginning of the film, he actually doesn't look or walk like me or sound like me. It was a really interesting and saddening exercise for me. I could not look at myself in the mirror before I went on set. It looked so crushed and defeated.
Yeah, I mean there is a certain sadness and heaviness to George Miller. You may say, Sir Ben, looking sprightly and full of beans yourself.
It's not my body language at all. I had to degenerate my body language for it to be the broken George, in order for Asa to have something to mend. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to present a broken man at the beginning of the film for our hero to fix him, and he actually uses that phrase during the film. Yeah. I think we can fix him.
The journey of the film is wonderful that they do. It is a magical film about the preservation of film, about cinema, about silent film as well, which seems to be back now. I don't wonder, as an actor, if you'd ever thought, well, I'd quite like to be in silent movies. How different would that be for you as an actor?
I really don't know until I experience it. You know, all I've undertaken is certain exercises in theatre, where in the rehearsal room, I remember the great director Peter Brook telling us to communicate with each other as actors without using any words. So it was all gesture and expression, and that was quite marvellous. But it was an exercise. It wasn't the end product. So I don't know what the end product would be like. I love language too much, I think, to stop talking, I'm afraid.
But even when you've done Beckett on stage, for example, there is a man who plugged into silent tradition on the stage, and I've seen you do it. There's sort of great use, recourse to the mime, if not to silent.
Yeah, in Waiting for Godot, there were amazing moments of stillness and silence. Mm. And it does have its value. Yeah. It does. I aspire towards, especially in front of 3D, a stillness as an actor. Even though I'm very active as George in his studio, whenever possible, I like to be completely still and let the camera find me rather than trying to reach out to the camera. That's wrong. You can't really do that.
Mm. I would say that's been the kind of the ace of many of your great performances, from Gandhi to Sexy Beast, in fact, which I was reminded of course, because you're united with Ray Winston here.
Yes,
I don't know if you were on set together. You weren't in the same scene.
No, we were never in the same scenes, Ray and I. But it's great to have him on the film set. Great to see him.
Yeah. And when you get back together, do you start shouting at him again?
No, we don't. We're very friendly and chummy when we get back together again.
Congratulations on you. Congratulations on George Méliès. I think he's a wonderful, wonderful character who will be one of your enduring creations as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Huge thanks to Sir Ben Kingsley there. And Hugo is on general release from this Friday, the 2nd of December. From Gandhi to Handy, Zan Brooks joins me in the studio, Guardian Critic at Large. She'll be here to review some of the week's other releases. Welcome back, Zan.
Thank you, Jason.
That was Sir Ben Kingsley, SBK, as I like to call him, in Hugo. Did you see Hugo?
I did see Hugo.
Martin Scorsese's Hugo. And what do you think of its clockwork mastery?
Well, I thought its clockwork mastery was very good. I thought it was beautiful to look at. I thought the 3D was good.
Yeah, wasn't it?
It's his ode to cinema. If I had any problem with it, it's a film about the magic of cinema that I watched thinking, oh, it's a film about the magic of cinema.
So that's not, you mean the magic didn't happen for
you?
Well,
this is it. You know, it's kind of a passive, earnest observer of the wonders of cinema, whether that's Georges Méliès or Harold Lloyd. And I kind of don't look to Scorsese for a lecture on the magic of cinema. I look to Scorsese for the magic of cinema.
Yeah, although if there's anyone to deliver a lecture on the magic of cinema, he has sort of done this a lot in his documentaries,
he
My
has.
Voyage
and
in Italy.
All of that is admirable, and it's entirely heartfelt, and there is a wonder to it. And yet this is the man who, you know, in the last 40 years is probably as responsible as anyone for creating moments of magic in cinema. Mm. It might not always be pretty, but it's vertiginous lift of film, and where you're thinking, I don't know where this is going, I don't know even what's happening now, but it's incredible.
Yeah.
Whereas with Hugo, I felt that I knew every time exactly where I was. It was this work of
clockwork
precision. Mm. But I'm not sure it's much more than that.
Yeah, see, I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. I got enchanted. I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was clever. I loved seeing the silent stuff, the train arriving at La Ciotat station,
yep,
where he recreated all the kind of people going, getting out of the way when the train came towards them, thinking that it was going to run them over, which was in 2D. But now we see it in 3D, and we see people in 3D. And I thought that was rather clever.
That was very... It's certainly a clever film. It's certainly...
Is it too clever for kids?
Well, I think it's a hard sell to kids. I mean, obviously, this is being marketed as the antidote to the loss of Harry Potter earlier this year.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's going to play. There's a very kind of Harry Potter-esque jaunty score throughout the film.
Yeah, sure.
That actually got a bit kind of irritating.
Yeah, I mean, it's got this. It's got the kind of kids stuff. It's got two kids, like Chloe Moretz and Asa Butterfield, lost in a station. They live in a station. That is kind of quintessentially kids stuff. They live in a kind of universe that is their own without adults, and they can muck about. That is Disney stuff. That is really interesting stuff. That said, I felt that you have to be a certain kind of literate kid. I mean, I think it will play very well in sort of Highbury and places like that where I live. You know, I think it's very much a, you know, Jocasta and Tarquin will enjoy this film because their parents take them to it. Is it going to be what a real 13, 14-year-old wants to see at the cinema, though?
I don't think so. I think it's very much the work of an older man, and it's what interests Scorsese, I guess, which would normally be what interests me too. But that's welded on to the Brian Selznick book and presumably the studio imperative of let's have a kids' film. So I found a lot of the characters, they didn't have any real depth to them. They were kind of like little cartoon archetypes going around.
Well, Sacha Baron Cohen, in particular, I thought was a sort of was a lame duck. I mean, he's lame in the film because he's got a wounded leg from Verdun. But that didn't work for me. The comedy didn't work for me.
And Richard Griffiths as the sort of the man who fancies the woman but keeps getting bitten by the dog. I didn't mind that little bit of French farciness. But Kingsley was very good in it, and the kids were good. And
it's got a sort of a latent classic kind of thing. I think 20 years from now, it'll be a classic.
Do you think
we will watch it on Christmas Day and enjoy it like
possibly? But it's too much of a sort of Christmas bauble, really. And I wasn't sure if there was anything behind it. Particularly
interesting, you've got Spielberg doing Tintin, and you've got Scorsese doing this.
It's a lot better than Tintin.
I thought so.
But at the same time, I just wish that Scorsese wasn't so reverent. I wish that he'd kind of let rip a little bit with this.
Well, I mean, it's his ode to the kind of, I suppose, magic box, those kind of great British films that he saw, almost the kind of Bedknobs and Broomsticks-y, Mary Poppins-y type films. And yet it isn't one of those, because he's kind of owed, you know, he's not really one of those directors. You know, he's kind of not a great comedian director. He's funny, funny how, like I amuse you, like I'm a clown, but he's not like, whoa, knockabout comedy. That's slightly its problem. That said, I thought it was enchanting. I mean, kind of masterly in many ways.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to differ on Hugo.
Yeah. Sir Ben, he'll beat you up. He's big, he's very well built, Sir
Well,
Ben.
I saw him in that Sexy Beast film, so I wouldn't cross him.
No. Right, Zan, we shall now look at Las Acacias from Argentina. We'll also look at We Have a Pope, or Habemus Papam, by Nanni Moretti. I can tell you about The Big Year, and you can tell me about Margaret as well, two US films to finish with. But we'll start with Las Acacias, which won the Camera d'Or in Cannes, and it also won the Sutherland Prize for the Best First Film at the London Film Festival recently. A propitious start for a film from Argentina.
¿Tenés familia?
No. Tengo un hijo.
¿Cuánto hace que no lo ves?
8 años.
Pablo Giorgelli is the first-time director, although he's quite old for a first-time director. I met him. He's about sort of 50 or something. I mean, he's been an editor for a long time. And I sort of wonder, you know, how this took so long to make, because ostensibly it's the simplest film in the world.
It is. It's basically man, woman, baby in a truck. It's about Ruben, who's a trucker hauling logs from Paraguay to Buenos Aires, and then to sort of pacify his boss, he agrees to give a lift to a single mum and her 5-month-old daughter.
Jacinta.
And he does so very unwillingly. He, at one stage,
he does everything quite unwillingly.
He does everything very unwillingly. He drives quite unwillingly with a sort of, you know, curmudgeonly grumble. At one stage, I think he tries to buy them bus tickets to sort of offload them. Doesn't really want to take them, particularly doesn't like the kids kind of screaming in the cab with him. And then inevitably a thaw kind of sets in, but very, very slowly. I mean, the first half hour is almost wordless. It's just the rumble of the engine.
It's interesting. It's also musicless as well. It is literally cars going past.
Sights and sounds on the freeway of, you know, northern Argentina. Yeah.
And it's not even a road movie in the kind of, you know, South American tradition of, say, Motorcycle Diaries, where interesting things happen on the way.
No, they don't really get out much.
They don't stop. They just keep going.
And yet, you know, if we're talking about magic in film, there's a sort of grubby, oily magic to this film, and in that it does build. You find yourself kind of looking at your wristwatch the start and thinking, you know, where is this going? And then your body clock kind of slows down to its rhythm. And after that, I was completely captivated.
Yeah, it's only 84 minutes, so yeah. Its spell is kind of short and good in that way. And you know that they're going to kind of have a rapprochement, these two.
Yeah.
The little five-month-old is going to melt his kind of curmudgeonly heart a bit, and we find a little bit about him.
Yeah.
But he doesn't even open up that much about his backstory.
Not even that much.
There's not very little dialogue. Is it a wonder? I mean, it's where you've got to wait to the end for any kind of emotional kind of payoff, yeah. I suppose. Did it happen for you?
It did. It did. The payoff, I thought, was beautiful, and beautiful because it waited and waited and waited until you're kind of almost salivating, and then the dam breaks. And this is actually a film that I would recommend to anyone.
Really?
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it's obviously it's slow, but it's perfect.
It is. There's very little fat on it. I sort of find myself kind of not quite loving it for some reason. I was waiting for the emotional payoff. It came. I was like, that's what I was expecting. It was a quiet slice of world cinema, and I like quiet slices of world
cinema.
You do, yeah. But it wasn't the whole cake for me.
Right, it wasn't the whole cake. I don't care if it was the whole cake or not. This was a slice of life, and that little slice. I'm really pushing the food metaphor here, aren't I? It was full of flavour and texture.
I don't know why it's called Lassacacia. Are they the trees that he was cutting down, the acacia trees?
I think they are, yeah, the trees in the back.
Yes.
They don't speak much either.
No, they don't really. I mean, I liked it. I was just a bit like, but I know some people really, really love it, and you're one of them, which is interesting to me. Shall we go for another bit of world cinema? Nanni Moretti, who has done such charms as the Sun's Room, probably the saddest film ever made, a Cannes-winning film. He's also done Dear Diary and April. But here he is addressing the religious implications of electing a new pope.
Beh, nei sogni invece sì. Beh, dipende dai sogni. Comunque no. Meglio di no. Meglio di no. Perfetto.
Now, this being Nanni Moretti, the kind of Woody Allen of Italy, we're looking at some kind of satire, I think, on religion, aren't we?
Well, you'd think that, wouldn't you? And I remember when this played in Cannes, there was, a real genuine anger that this wasn't the film that people were expecting to see. That this is, you know, Nanni Moretti taking on the Vatican. And the first couple of moments of it seem to lead us to believe that this is what he's going to do. It takes us sort of behind the scenes at the conclave and the Holy See. And
something I've never seen before. I mean, I'm no great expert on papal movies, but
and obviously not actually shot there. I think it was shot at Cinecittà in Rome.
Oh, was it?
It's
but I think they used some footage of when the old Pope.
I think they do. Yeah. There's certainly some archive footage in there.
Can I call him that?
You can. Yeah, he listens regularly. And, you know, we see the archbishops on their exercise bikes or having a crafty cigarette in their rooms and things like that. And you're thinking, oh, this is going to be this sort of black comic farce. And yet it's not that at all.
Did we get it wrong? I mean, did I get that idea of the comedy wrong? Because it started with comic conviction, as you say, and then it sort of tapers off.
It tapers off, but then it goes in different directions.
Yeah,
well, you've got the sort of the new pope, who's elected pope, who's Melville, played by the wonderful old actor Michel Piccoli.
Isn't he brilliant?
Who promptly freaks out when he comes to address the masses and does a runner, and they hire Nanni Moretti as the psychoanalyst. They hire Nanni Moretti as the psychoanalyst to try and put him straight. But then he goes out on the streets of Rome, and really what he wants to do is play Chekhov. It's always been his dream to be an actor and play Chekhov. And in telling this plot, I'm aware that it's almost sort of five films in one.
Yeah.
It's almost as if Moretti got to the end of each scene and then thought, now what?
Where do we go?
Where
now?
Do we go? Yeah. What do we do?
That's the sort of filmmaker he often is.
He's doing his little autobiographical kind of scrapbooks and snapshots of Italian life and his role in Italian life. That is sort of wonderful. But this is by its nature a more kind of high concept film that has a lot of baggage.
Yeah.
You're taking on the papacy with this. And to have that sort of ambling sort of, you know, maybe that feels a bit redundant in a way.
Yeah, I mean, and then, like the Monty Python and the philosophy football sketch, he organises, while they're waiting for the Pope to return, he organises a volleyball tournament between the world's cardinals.
Yeah.
Now, this might have looked good on paper, but to me, on screen, it just looked silly, to use another Monty Python.
Yeah, it becomes
expression.
Like sort of Cool Runnings or something,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Insane,
where you just got
really?
The Popes playing volleyball.
But should that be brilliantly surreal? I mean, it went on a very long time for something that was surreal.
Yeah.
I didn't get it at all.
Not at all. It sounds like this film? I'm really down on this film.
Yeah, it's and actually, I thought you were going to say actually it's really good.
It's not really good, but it's harmless.
Yeah, it's being touted as a sort of Christmas. It's being remarketed. I was very surprised that someone bought it. Soda Pictures bought it here and there.
They're kind of
retooling it as a kind of Christmas treat. You know,
well, at its best, it's a bit sort of Frank Capra, a bit Ernst Lubitsch. It's the great man who falls from the mountain and wanders among the real people of Rome and gets a sort of an education, and people are good to him and people are nice to him.
It's a lovely scene.
That bit is lovely. And yet it doesn't even follow through on that. Yeah.
Leaving the famous balcony of St. Peter Square sort of vacant when they're waiting, here comes the Pope, and he's not a runner.
Yeah.
That's kind of great. That's a good sort of great comic thing. You spend ages setting that up and it sort of does. And then he's off running and Bishop Piccoli is great. But I didn't have a clue. Really.
I'm saying it's harmless, but actually, is that really what you want for a satire or a comedy about the Holy See, the conclave?
No, when you've got a psychoanalyst kind of taking on, you know, faith versus empiricism, and it kind of should be kind of huge battle. It sort of isn't, though,
is
it?
It's unfulfilled at every turn, and it's perfectly passable, and I like Moretti, but this film is, I think, a failure.
Me too. We don't have much hope for We Have a Pope, but maybe we do for The Big Year. It's a comedy. It stars Steve Martin, Owen Wilson and Jack Black. They're all bird watchers. How can it fail?
You ever get the feeling you're being followed?
Hello, Master. How you doing, Stu? Still filling those weekends, I see. Unless you and your son here are doing a big year.
Kenny Bostick, this is my friend, Brad Harris, who's also not doing a big year.
Big-footed goose! Big-footed goose, other end of the boardwalk!
Oh, you're careful.
Now, Zan, you haven't seen this. I have.
I can't imagine why I've somehow missed this.
Can I sell this to you?
Please do.
It's directed by David Frankel, who did Marley and Me. So he's got I don't know what it is, some kind of gift for kind of getting the animal and the spiritual, you know, and feeding from the animal kingdom into the... These are all bird watchers. Jack Black is a kind of hapless, rather overweight office worker. Owen Wilson wants to be the greatest birder in the world and sees over 750 species in North America in a year. That is the big year. You go and you get the most species and you can win for the big year.
What do you win?
Nothing. It's a feather in your cap, quite literally. And Steve Martin is a kind of, you know, New York, owns a big firm in New York and decides to retire for a bit and go and do a big year. And so these three of them are out for a big year and they're kind of, you know, out to kind of out-twitch each other. Who can see the lesser spotted plover or the great grey...
It does sound absolutely fantastic, the way you're describing it.
I cannot believe how poor this film is, given that the talent's involved. I mean, it is an absolute mess. I mean, it doesn't ever decide whether bird watchers are kind of nerds, which, you know, that is a kind of common trait in American cinema. Let's get these nerds and we can laugh at them. It doesn't have any great bird photography in it, which you'd have thought, well, it would at least do that. It doesn't tell you why bird watching might be interesting at all. It is a complete failure and then decides to draw life lessons. I was kind of, it's a two-star kind of movie.
Right.
And then it started going, if you don't get all your birds, at least you should be able to kind of impregnate your wife, because back home, Rosamund Pike plays Owen Wilson's wife, and of course he doesn't go and impregnate her. He goes and sees a snowy owl instead in the tundra. And it's all about, well, he might have won the birder of the year, but he didn't get a baby, and this is, you know, we are...
But isn't it a bit, you know, isn't the birds a metaphor for, you know, the characters taking flight and living the dream and
should
know,
be,
dropping
isn't.
Guano on the
not,
floor?
Not at all. No, it is all about the getting shat on.
Spilling their own seed.
Yeah, an absolute disaster. Disastrous film, and like Steve Martin is terrible in it, as only he can be when he wants to be. And Jack Black, terrible, falling over with his rucksack on, lots of kind of, really awful, awful film. And I don't even want to say it's charming in any way. It makes Marley and Me look like a Citizen Kane of animal movies.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think that's a year to forget.
It is a year to forget.
Shall I tell you about Margaret?
Tell me about...
Because I went and saw Margaret.
Yes. If that was my annus horribilis, maybe Margaret. What is Margaret? I didn't know what Margaret was. I didn't go and see it because I don't like the name Margaret. I don't get the
There's
name
no Margaret,
Margaret
in it. Margaret, the name, is lifted from a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins that's quoted.
Oh, so I like him in his surf.
You see?
Okay, Margaret.
You should have taken a gamble.
So what is Margaret?
Margaret is a film by Kenneth Lonergan, the writer-director who gave us, You Can Count on Me, 11 years
Oscar
ago.
Oscar nominee. Has he done
Which was
since?
Fantastic. He's done pretty much, I mean, he's done plays, but... This was a film that he made 5 years ago, and he made it for 3 hours long, re-edited it like a madman. I think it became a sort of obsession for him. Fell into dispute with the studio, lots of kind of legal actions. The film's been delayed till now. It's now cut down to 2.5 hours. I think Scorsese and Thelma Shoemaker kind of helped finally get a version together.
Really?
So it comes in with the stench of failure all over it, and yet it's kind of brilliant.
Do you remember me from the bus accident?
It's a tragedy. You cannot bring her back.
I'm talking about telling the accident investigators what really happened.
But you already talked to them.
I know that, but I lied.
You're going to go home, you're going to do your homework, and I'm going to lose my job.
So, if I'm not mistaken, Anna Paquin?
Anna Paquin is in it. Anna Paquin plays Lisa, who's a child of divorce. She's a sort of precocious brat on the streets of New York, who flirts with her maths teacher, played by Matt Damon. She then flirts with a bus driver, played by Mark Ruffalo, indirectly causing a fatal collision, after which everything falls apart. It's completely... She's devastated. She's sort of partly orchestrating the drama for herself. She's sort of spinning this tragedy into a wider tragedy. She is a total drama queen. But along the way, Lonergan whips up this brilliant sort of buzzing, darting portrait of societal kind of collapse. It's a real sort of post 9/11 movie.
Right.
There's a big cast. It's running around through various sort of parallel plot lines.
Are we in New
characters.
York?
We're in New York the whole time. Maybe the final hour of it, you can have the sense that something has happened to this film. You can almost feel the scissor marks on it, that some scenes end too quickly or others kind of are too explosive and they don't sit quite right together. But even that sort of weirdly adds to this mood of something beginning to fall apart.
Well, it sounds extraordinary. It sounds like a folly, of course, but it also sounds like something really worth
seeing.
It's
hugely ambitious. It's brilliantly acted, particularly by Paquin, who's absolutely superb in it. Utterly dislikable, but we kind of relate to her. Lonergan focuses on her so forensically that we start to kind of respond to her a bit.
And Ruffalo, who seems... He
and
must
Ruffalo's
be Lonergan's,
always
because he came
good.
To the fore in Lonergan's You Can Count
yeah,
on Me. That
he
was
did,
his
yeah.
first role.
Yeah. He's good. Damon's good. J. Smith Cameron, who... is, I think, Lonergan's off-screen wife, plays the character Lisa's mum, who's this sort of slightly fading Broadway actress. Mm. Jean Reno's in there as this sort of seedy Colombian businessman.
Well, it sounds great. Well, I don't know why I missed this.
It's really good. Check it out.
Margaret, well, I wish I'd paid attention to that one, Zan. Thank you for filling me in on that. Zan, we must not leave without mentioning Ken Russell, who passed away this week. I noticed you were writing fulsomely about him. I was talking about him as well. Do I love Ken Russell? Would you go home and stick a Ken Russell DVD on and have a little look at it? Is that what you... Where does he sit in your pantheon?
Well, the weird thing about somebody like Russell dying is that you realise when he's dead that for the last 10 years he's been this sort of florid clown figure whose films seem faded and dated and you know, he's the sort of the madman in the woods kind of, you know, chuntering on. And then when he dies, you look back and you actually think, no, he really did matter. And maybe he didn't matter for that long. Maybe he didn't make that many great movies. But I come away from this week really wanting to revisit, you know, Women in Love, The Devils, which obviously the full version has barely ever been seen, and I think it's being re-released
coming
on DVD,
out on DVD yeah.
next year. Altered States, which is a great film.
Yeah, I always quite liked Gothic.
Gothic was okay. I don't think I'd beat a retreat back to Gothic.
No, Women in Love is the one worth watching.
Yeah,
and
I guess the problem with him was that he was this sort of mix of these very high-toned films and fascinated with classical music, and then the sensibility of, you know, the English seaside postcard. And that sort of didn't always sit well, but it was still an audacious marriage. And when it worked, he was a one-off. He was a genius in his way.
A total one-off, indeed. Ken Russell. We shall not look upon his like again.
I don't think we will.
The most fitting tribute to him. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
For all of Zan's reviews and tributes, go to guardian.co.uk/film. And that brings us to a close for this week. The music we've been featuring in the show is Howard Shore's lavish score for Martin Scorsese's Hugo, which I think is a bit of a masterpiece, as you heard earlier. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.